This is The Source on Texas Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. When a newborn takes his or her first breath, it's a miracle of nature. The little lungs inflate for the first time, a respiratory dynamic system kicks in. It's amazing. But frequently, that infant is going to need help keeping those gulps of air coming and then begin to thrive. But not all babies have access to the same amount of care and help for that first year of life. Here in San Antonio, we're seeing the income gap and other barriers result in a high infant mortality rate. A new study in Texas shows us that infant mortality is more common with Hispanic babies in low-income households. What's being done to address this? How can our community provide better support for the young mothers and their infants? And what do you want to see done about San Antonio's high infant mortality rate? Call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet us at @tprsource. We're joined this afternoon by Corey Ellerby. She is the health manager for the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District's Healthy Start program. Dr. Eileen Naimi is a member of the UT System Population Health Team and a contributor to the report, Infant Mortality in Communities Across Texas. And Dr. Sanjay Garza Cox, the MedNax-affiliated neonatologist at the Children's Hospital of San Antonio. And welcome all of y'all. I appreciate you all coming in this afternoon to talk about this important topic. Dr. Eileen, let me ask you first, since you contributed to this report, tell us more about it and the findings.
Yeah, sure. So this project is really a data project, and it's part of a larger effort in my office to produce local measures of community health. So infant mortality rates being the first that we're putting out, but we're also looking at putting out rates or prevalences of low birth weight, preterm birth, and some of these other maternal health and child health indicators so that local communities can better focus their resources and target their interventions. Right now, most of these kinds of health indicators are available. They're really only available at the smallest area, maybe at the county level. So this is a way of putting out information that hopefully local communities can use to target their efforts. And it also can help in seeking funds. Sometimes it's important to be able to say, why are you focusing in this particular neighborhood? And having those local rates is valuable. So what we did was we used data that is collected by the Texas Department of State Health Services, DSHS. And these are vital statistics records, so these are the birth and death records that are collected by the state, and then they create a data set that then can be used to generate these kinds of measures. And so the data set that we used was looked at babies that were born between 2011 and 2014, so that four-year period in Texas. And then DSHS does a matching, so they look at the death records. If that baby, any of those babies died within 1 year of life, that information is contained in the data set that they provide to us. So we calculated those rates of infant mortality, which is how many babies have died before their first birthday for every 1,000 babies born. So it's usually we use the percentages, which is per 100, and this is per 1,000. And so that's the standard way that infant mortality rates are calculated. And so what we saw for Texas overall, that infant mortality rate in this time period with this data set was 5.48. And so, Texas is doing okay in terms of infant mortality, and we have been similar to national rates for the past 10 years. But what we wanted to be able to show is that the variation across our large state, and that variation at the local level, so that we can unmask some of those pockets where we need to be focusing our efforts so we can really accelerate this effort to reduce infant mortality. And we looked a little bit at within San Antonio, and we also were able to look at by race ethnicity. And I should mention that these rates are, we're somewhat limited in which zip codes we can use. So they had to have at least 400 births during that four-year time period just to have a stable enough estimate. So we looked within race ethnicity as well at the zip code level, and so there had to be at least 400 births to moms, those each race ethnic group, to be able to calculate those rates. So we have a lot of empty zip codes, but what we did see looking in San Antonio is the range, there were zip codes that had as few as 1.9 IMR up to 14.98. So there's there's quite a range in terms of overall zip code population. And then we were able to look within the white and Hispanic populations. There's a couple zip codes that had enough black births that we were able to look within those as well. So that's kind of an overview of what we saw, but there is a range, and some of the Hispanic zip codes in San Antonio, which we highlighted in the report, there were a couple of zip codes where the infant mortality rates were more than double what we saw at the state average. And in general, whites and Hispanics have lower infant mortality rates than blacks, but we also can recognize that there are pockets where that's not the case, and we need to understand that and work to address it.
So zip codes are key into understanding these data sets, and zip codes were created by the post office to deliver mail, not to look at public health trends.
Correct. And there are better measures of community. The census tracts or census block groups, they're a little bit more of a community barrier. And as researchers, and we have to figure out what's the best unit to use. There were a few reasons that we went with zip code. I think census it has to do with the numbers and how large that geographic area is.
Is this a convenient way to try and we have these people and they provide information.
Yeah.
We know their zip codes and we can kind of do it that way. That it would be great if there was a better way to look at this, but this is what we have.
Yeah. And people are very familiar with zip codes, so they can relate to it and know what the boundaries are. And I think for the Healthy Start, there are some funding agencies that want to look at it by zip code level. So that's how we ended up having it at the zip code.
So here in San Antonio,
our community.
So here in San Antonio, we're looking at two zip codes, 78203 and 78220, which are they're conjoined. They're right next to each other, and they're on San Antonio's east side. And what do we know from those zip codes?
So we had just looking at the Hispanic infant mortality rates in those two zip codes. In 78203 there were 16 infant deaths per 1,000 births, so 1.6%, and then in 78220 that rate was 11.6 per 1,000 births. And so these are high, these are high for the Hispanic population, and they're high. They're an area. It indicates as an area where you want to focus.
We can use that information maybe to provide services. We're going to dig more into that. We're going to take a quick break. Our phone line is open, 210-614-8980. If you're in these zip codes, we'd love to hear from you, 78203, 78220. What's your reaction to having your zip codes as being the worst in San Antonio for infant mortality rate? Call in, 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about infant mortality here in San Antonio. Nationally, we are have a higher infant mortality than almost every other developed country in the world. And then here locally in San Antonio, we have zip codes that are extremely high. And these are two zip codes, so 78203, 78220. And what does that mean? And is that, now that we know this information, should we be able to focus this area and provide services and make changes? Let me go to some of my other guests that we have here this afternoon. And Corey Eberle is with us. She's the health manager for the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District Healthy Start program. And can you talk about Healthy Start and what this means?
Absolutely. So Healthy Start, we have a grant from the Health Resources and Services Administration. It's part of the Maternal Child Health Bureau at the federal level. And this type of data is really useful to what we do. We actually got our grant here in San Antonio based on the infant mortality rates in census tracts. So just to kind of speak back to Dr. Naimi's description of how different funders and different people look at data, that's definitely what they do. So we have specific service areas. We have a tract in the Northeast, we have a tract in the South, and a tract in the West that comprises a whole bunch of different census tracts put together, and they had to be adjacent, and they all had to have a certain infant mortality rate that at the time of the of writing the grant was over 10.9. So very similar, you know, edging up to the rates that we see here in the two zip codes. So it's very useful to look at the data at this community level, and we focus our current efforts that way. We do in-home case management, so parent, you know, education, parental education, teaching people about what a healthy pregnancy looks like, what they can do to stay healthy, what they can do to prepare so that their child's first couple years of life are healthy and that they remain safe. We also have neighborhoods initiatives. So to speak to that kind of place-based effect, we have groups that go out, do outreach education, talk to residents, look at strengths, gaps, develop assets that are existing in the communication in the communities, and try to strengthen those things. We also have a fetal infant mortality review team that's been doing active reviews for about a year and a half now. And really what that allows us to do is to look at individual cases of death and drill down into baby and mom and what conditions existed. And really what we have learned that we want to look at rather than just the medical information, stuff you can get from charts, is the social determinants of health. And that's really what we're talking about, that when you look at the zip code level data that's in the report that we're talking about, those are the conditions that exist that affect health. They're not health, but they definitely affect it. You mentioned a few of them in your intro. Transportation, you know, those barriers that people have, childcare, you know, mental health, substance abuse, all those things that kind of come together to really affect how people's health is before they get pregnant, their health during care while they're prenatal, and then the health of the mom and baby afterwards and the health of the household. So those social determinants of health are really key when you're looking at differences in various parts of our community. And when you see the changes, the disparities across the community, that's what we're talking about.
Right. So there's a lot of different factors.
Yes.
But we're looking for some that can be addressed easily. And things like the sleeping boxes that I'm hearing about. Co-sleeping is an issue. And then by giving it, we'll talk about that.
Definitely, and I think Dr. Cox can probably also talk about that as well, but safe sleep is definitely an issue. We want to make sure that safe sleep conditions exist.
What is a sleeping box?
A baby box. A baby box is actually it's just what it sounds like. It's a box that you put the baby in. Basically, the ABCs are what you need to remember in terms of safe sleep. You want the baby alone on their back and nothing else in the environment. So they need to be isolated. So a baby box is a way that many organizations promote. Healthy Start, we actually issue pack and plays to give that kind of solo environment so that the baby has those conditions existent to create safe sleep. Co-sleeping is a problem here in San Antonio. We know that, you know, whether it's due to housing, you know, small housing, and so you have people sleeping together, kids in the same bed, pets in the same bed, parents and kids in the same bed, those kinds of things. It happens, but it's not safe because things can happen. You can have rollover, you can have suffocation, all those kinds of things. So safe sleep is one of those preventable causes that's
and so you tell
for us
we're going
to
put the baby to sleep in the box, and you just can't take like the box from the Bush beer that you had or whatever. You got to have an actual sanitized box. So can you talk about that, Dr. Cox?
Yes. We actually recommend that the child simply be alone on his back with no items surrounding. We prefer the baby is in the mom's room. We have learned that babies who sleep in the same room, so you can co-sleep is sleeping in the same room, co-bed is sleeping with the baby. So we do want moms and dads to sleep in the same room as the baby because they are more attentive to the noises the baby may be making or any struggling the baby may have. The baby needs to be, whether it's in a box, and the box can be any box truly. The reason why the baby box is so appealing is because it comes with a flat mattress that is not very soft, and nothing else can go around it. Plus, it's very easy to put on the side of mom's bed, or if what we see in San Antonio is an increased death, number of deaths on babies who are sleeping in air mattresses with their siblings. And we believe that that is happening because of economy issues, but also because the houses are small. So everybody's got to sleep in the same living room. If you had something small like a box or a playpen, that could be next to the air mattress, and the baby will be right there with you, but it would be safe. So that's the appealance of a baby box, but it doesn't have to be the baby box.
We do know that breastfeeding is important for the child's health, and also just, you know, helping connect to the babies, all sorts of great things. Is breastfeeding something that needs to be looked at here, Dr. Cox?
Breastfeeding, actually, we have a very low rate of breastfeeding in San Antonio and Bexar County. All the hospitals are trying their best to continue to educate and encourage and give the support of the mother's need once they get discharged from the hospital. That's when we see the fastest rate of breastfeeding fall out because parents get into their regular routine and they're exhausted and it's easier to do the bottle. We do know that breast milk being fed to the baby reduces mortality, especially with SIDS, and it also reduces problems in the future like obesity and diabetes. So we are working very, very hard in the hospitals to make sure that parents are encouraged to breastfeed, but then just like safe sleep, everything goes well during the hospital and the education happens, but when they get discharged home, sometimes they don't have the support.
Dr. Eileen Naimi, in your study, do you look at these types of factors?
So we are, again, this is for the first wave is really about putting the data out there. And so some of the other variables that we are gearing up to put out are very much those that are related to infant mortality. So some of the big ones are maternal obesity rates, the smoking during pregnancy, if the inter-pregnancy interval is short, so if the woman's getting repeat pregnancies, and then inadequate prenatal care, teen pregnancy rates, so these are all, and also, of course, preterm and low birth weight rates as well. And so just putting that information out there can help. So if you identify there's a zip code with a high infant mortality rate, what are these other factors that exist in that community that we want to target if we want to increase or we want to lower the infant mortality rates? We are going to be doing more of an analytic look where we actually say, well, which of these factors are the most important ones. But there is a lot that's already known about infant mortality and what we need to do to address it. So some of these, the issue of safe sleep, but also, you know, maternal smoking, obesity, inter-pregnancy intervals. So these are all things that are addressable as well.
Let's go to the phone lines. Numbers 210-614-8980. And John is on the line. Hi, John. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is, with the numbers and percentages quoted, does that include homicides and manslaughter? If it doesn't, why not? And if it does, then can't we make a lot of progress by just telling people not to put their newborn unwanted infants in dumpsters and chaining them to the backyard, to dog pens, and that kind of stuff that seems to be prevalent in San Antonio?
All right, John, thank you for the call. So abuse and neglect, is that something that is factored in here, Dr. Eileen?
Yeah, so this is whatever the cause of death. They're included in this in these infant mortality rates, but it's important to know that you know, abuse and neglect are not primary drivers of infant mortality. We actually see low birth weights, about 70%. These are low birth weight infants or preterm births, and that's, you know, where we see a lot of these deaths are occurring, you know, due to that prematurity, and these are things that have their roots in the context in which the mother is. The pregnancy is occurring. So both the mother's health behaviors, but also, you know, the larger community. So the quality and appropriateness of her prenatal care and other factors, socioeconomic factors. And then certainly there are some conditions outside after the baby's born. But we're not seeing that the primary driver is abuse and neglect.
So let me go to Corey Eberle at the Healthy Start Program, and you've come in contact with families who have lost children.
Absolutely.
And so these are children that are wanted. These are families that are going through a horrible, horrible tragedy. Is that right?
Absolutely. Both in, you know, our home visiting program and also through our FEMR, our Fetal Infant Mortality Review. And just to echo what was just said, what we have found in our local review of births is that the most common factors we find that are correlated with infant death is premature birth, low birth weight, birth defects, maternal age, and pre-existing maternal health conditions. So her preconception health, those things like obesity, diabetes, those kinds of things that are going on, are the major factors, and unsafe sleep conditions. So we see that, and we really try to help families learn about what they can do to control their health conditions, do that reproductive life planning that we're talking about, where we talk about birth spacing, what's the optimal time. You know, optimally you should wait 18 months to 2 years after you deliver before you have your next child. You should be in good health before you conceive. These kinds of things really help, and having the resources and knowing where to find resources that can help you overcome some of these barriers that we're talking about that exist in certain communities more than others are really what home visiting programs like Healthy Start and others in the community are about.
But these two zip codes, 78203, 78220, they're not the only zip codes in San Antonio that are dealing with economic stress, and but these are certainly in that category. Is there anything else in these two zip codes that sets them apart?
Well, when you look at the data, you are correct. I mean, we have pockets everywhere. That's how our service tracks were developed, as I mentioned. But, you know, when you look at those at the east side and these two zip codes, we have some of the highest density of alcohol retailers in the city. There's only one zip code that's higher. Higher incidence of smokers. So, you know, some of these things that contribute to health really, in addition to the low birth weight, the prematurity and thing, you know, transportation barriers, those kinds of things that exist everywhere. There, it really is different. I mean, you look at the east side in general, and in this concentrated area that we're looking at in particular, the life expectancy overall can be as much as 20 years less than north side. Their north side comparative zips. So we really are talking about conditions that affect the life course.
Right. So typically when we talk about the quality of public health in any area, infant mortality is one of those signs that we look at, one of those indexes. It's very telling. And so as we talk about the high infant mortality in 78203, 78220, we're finding out, this is telling us that there's a public health crisis in those two areas and in many places of San Antonio. And we want to talk about that this afternoon. We want you to give us a call. What is your experience with infant mortality in your family? We really want to hear your personal story. Maybe you could help us inspire others to take action. Change some minds about preconceptions about that. Did you have prenatal care and support that you needed after giving birth? Please give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The source continues after this break.
This week on Fronteras, Minorities in Education. From a financial academy that offers classes in 50 languages to serve its refugee students, to recruiting Hispanic students into nursing.
This is how you start. This is the prerequisites you need. And if you're interested, we're going to now connect you with a mentor so that they can help you along the way.
Download Fronteras wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Infant mortality, unfortunately, it is no stranger to San Antonio, and in particularly two zip codes, 78203, 78220. We're showing high rates among Hispanics in this area, and this is it's in contrast to the state rate of 5.8 deaths based in the 2011-2014 data. What questions do you have for experts about keeping your infant healthy? How did you learn to care for your infant? Who told you what needed to be done to keep your child safe during that critical first year of life? The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. And Gene is on the line. Gene, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. It's nice to be with your guests. I just wanted to mention that something that hasn't been brought up that I know of, and that is there's three items that haven't been covered, and one is sound, because sound is could be very detrimental. Secondly, one would be smell, because the child is very accustomed to the mother or father's smell, and taste. You know, kissing a mother or kissing a father, they know who they're kissing. Those items are very important to have them introduced into your conversation. I don't know why they haven't. Maybe they just haven't gone up yet. But.
All right, Gene, thank you so much. There are a lot of factors that come into this. And I think where he's getting at is a feeling of security and nurturing that a child should have, and avoiding unnecessary stress on a baby. And a baby does feel stress, Dr. Cox?
Yes, actually, babies do feel a lot of stress. We actually have found out that those babies that have been exposed to narcotics in utero are very sensitive to very high levels, and the only thing they tolerate is the mother's voice and lullabies. So if they live in areas where it's very low, whether it's a baby who is withdrawing or not, could affect the way that baby develops and can be calmed down. If the baby's calm and only waking up for feedings and being able to be more cuddled and loved, then you have that bonding that prevents also that mother and that father from being, you know, co-sleeping.
The imprinting.
Right, the imprinting.
And feeding breast milk, I think, is an absolutely great way to do that. I mean, if you're breastfeeding, you get all those senses with baby. You know, the
you
touch,
to face,
the
smell,
the taste, all of that is covered, that attachment that the baby needs. And dad can feed breast milk out of a bottle as well. So you get that from dad, too. So, you know, things like Baby Cafe that Metro Health has, where we teach women to, you know, their drop-in centers. They have lactation consultants. If you're having trouble, as Dr. Cox said, you know, once they leave the hospital, you need some resources. So, you know, in-home programs like Healthy Start, or, you know, a drop-in lactation center like Baby Cafe is a really great way to keep that up and get that contact that you need. So you don't have to do it while you're co-bedding. Is that what you call
co-bedding,
it, Dr. Cox?
Yes.
Co-bedding.
Now, something that we need to not forget is also the smoking. So that's the sense of smell, right? So if the mother smokes while she's pregnant, her baby, her placenta is not going to develop as big and healthy as it should be, and so her child will not be as healthy. We know moms who smoke are more likely to have complications during pregnancy and after. And also, we know babies who are exposed to smoke have more incidence of sleeping death.
Like secondhand smoke?
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. And also third-hand smoke, because if you smoke in your home, it's in the bedding, it's in the curtains, it's in the carpet, babies crawl, it's in your hair, you know, so really there's you know, all kinds of effects from tobacco use and smoking in particular.
Another caller, the number is 210-614-8980. Regina, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm Regina.
Yeah.
I just wanted to let you know, I took all the classes you could imagine offered by the hospital I had my daughter at, and it was breastfeeding, daddy classes, mommy and me classes, everything you could imagine. And, of course, everything was pushed geared towards breastfeeding. And I had, like, a weird liver problem. It's called cholestasis, so I had to deliver my daughter about 3 weeks early. And my milk had not come in, but nobody told me, like, they told me, like, yes, just keep breastfeeding. And, of course, by day three when I got discharged, like, my baby was in a horrible scream. And I couldn't keep my head up. I was drenched. I was drained. I couldn't handle the whole breastfeeding. Of course, my milk hadn't come in, and nobody told me this, that it would take time for my milk to come in. And, of course, my mother was staying with me for about a week helping me to take care of the baby, and she goes, she's hungry. This is the problem. You need to give her formula. And the thing is that none of these classes said, like, hey, keep some formula in case your milk doesn't come in, just to supplement while you do breastfeed. And that was, like, really hard for me. It was one of the hardest nights. I felt like the most terrible mother on earth. And, of course, I think that this should be explained to everybody, because even after I had that experience, I went online and people had their children had passed away because, yes, breastfeed, but nobody tells you, like, you don't know if your breast milk is coming out or not. You can't feel it.
Regina, thank you so much for that important call. So Dr. Cox, can you talk about some of those issues?
Yes, point well taken. She is correct. Sometimes we focus on breastfeeding only, that we forget to support the mother. So we, as the mother is educated, we need to educate, and we have been trying to do better in educating the mothers on what signs to look at time of discharge. We discuss with them, you know, how many diapers they're supposed to have, how many bowel movements they're supposed to have. If the child becomes very irritable, it's probably because the baby is hungry. So there is the time, there is special situations due to mom's medications or mom's conditions where the milk doesn't come in as fast as one would wish. And we need to make sure that we counsel the mothers on what they can do in the meantime and continue to try to breastfeed, because breast milk is second to none, and we need that breast milk to protect the infant, but not if it's harming the infant because he's not getting enough.
Well, they talk about nipple confusion for an infant and the inability to, so, and now you're holding up, so don't talk about nipple confusion.
It depends on who you discuss. We want breastfeeding established first, and then introduce the nipple after 3 to 4 weeks of life. There is some literature that documents nipple confusion exists, and then there's some literature that disproves it. So we want to establish breastfeeding first.
Right, but if you don't have the milk, then you introduce the bottle, and is that going to, because, you know, latching on for an infant is, how does that, you know, so give me some help here.
Drinking from a bottle for an infant is easier.
Yeah, it's easy.
Than drinking from a breast. So a lot of the problem comes in when we just stop working on it. And we need to, if we're going to breastfeed the baby and the milk doesn't come in and we need to give him a bottle, we recommend that moms pump. The least you breastfeed, the least milk you're going to produce. So it's a supply and demand. We do encourage babies to be healthy and obviously to be well hydrated. And if we use the bottle, that's fine, as long as the mom continues to pump.
But breast milk in and of itself, that substance is, you
it's
know,
gold.
Yeah, there's no other substitute for it.
No.
And after, I mean, a lot of moms work, and so if you want to continue to provide breast milk after you go back to work in a couple months, unless you're able to get baby to you, you have to pump and use a bottle. So, you know, breast.
So now you got a team. You got to have a team help.
Yes, you need a team.
And so is that a problem here with infant mortality, is that you don't have a team? We've got single moms, and they're not really getting all the support that they need.
Absolutely. And I think that's, again, one of those social determinants of health and things that when you look at all of the factors that break down in particular communities, you see higher incidence of folks who aren't married or, you know, single parenting, that kind of thing, single moms. That's a factor. And really, it takes a village. You know how they say that? And that really, really is true. I mean, unless we all marshal around supporting good reproductive health as a community, as a neighborhood, as families, we're really not going to see these rates go down. That's why our country as a whole is in the position that we are with poor infant mortality rates.
And so, but some people say it's counterintuitive that we're talking about this being a problem in Hispanic households. And you talk about how many people are crowded into this house all living together. isn't everyone kind of working on team baby, or are they not?
Yes, everybody. The families, typically, whether they're Hispanic or not, even when single mothers, a lot of them have support from their own family. The problem comes down to access and education. Bringing back the breastfeeding issue, just as an example, so a mother wants to continue to breastfeed. She knows the best for her baby, but she doesn't have the money or the ability to go get a breast pump. Say that she did get the breast pump through WIC or somebody else, then who is teaching her to use it effectively and to use it appropriately so that she doesn't feel she's hurting herself or hurting the baby? And that's just an example. So you can have your entire family support, but education and access are key.
Can I give one more example? So we were talking about early entry to prenatal care, you know, and prenatal care is so very important. There are things we can find in the first trimester that if they're going wrong, they can be addressed in the first trimester. And after that, some of those things can't. So it's really important to get that. And that family support, one of the things that people who are supporting a pregnant woman can do is watch her other kids while she goes to the doctor for her prenatal visits. It's something maybe that we don't think about, and that's not something that even a family member has to do. Someone, you know, from the neighborhood could also help out. There are ways we can help support reproductive life at many levels.
Right. So we're going to hit another break, but going to break, I just mentioned the fact that these two zip codes, 78203, 78220, are sort of transportationally isolated. They're not really on a main line, not a lot of public transportation in and out of those areas, and whether or not that fits into that as well. What are some of the difficulties that you think people, young moms and young families have in these areas, 78203, 78202, other parts of San Antonio, things that we can do to improve these outcomes, try to make this a goal for San Antonio, that we reduce our overall infant mortality rate? Is this something that we can take on? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. Everett, hang on. I'm going to get your call when we come back from break. It's 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. A new study in Texas shows us that infant mortality is more common with Hispanic babies living in low-income households. What's being done to address this here in San Antonio? What can our community provide to get better support to these young mothers and their infants? Can we do a moonshot here locally to lower our infant mortality rate? The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. And Everett, welcome to The Source. Everett, you're on the air.
Hey, I listen to you guys every chance I get, so thanks for taking my call. So the thing that I wanted to mention is what helped us out, my wife and I, was a book called What to Expect. And we found that book to be so on point. At every turn, we would refer to that book. Like, for instance, the other caller mentioned no one told her that the breast milk, what happens, the breast milk doesn't come. But the book, we learned, was that there's actually a substance that comes out first. And it's about a week after, it takes about a week for the breast milk to start to develop. But that particular substance was critical in the preparation for the baby to ingest the breast milk. So it's like all by design, but if you don't know it, then, you know, you're going to blow right by it. And, of course, the culture is such that, well, we don't want the mother to feel bad, you know, don't worry about it, you don't have to do it. But if we change the culture, we'll find more and more mothers doing it. I would just recommend getting that book to all the brand new babies or mothers out there, and they'll find even the crying and everything. So I wanted to tell you that. Thanks for taking my call. It was awesome.
Everett, thank you for that call. So What to Expect when you're expecting, or do you give that a similar rave review, Dr. Cox?
I'm going to have to confess, but I actually did read it also before my very first child.
And we had it.
It was very helpful. It is extremely helpful to be able to read it before you're pregnant, and definitely.
Did you buy it yourself, or did someone give it to you?
No, I bought it myself.
And I bought mine too.
Well, maybe we should, if this is such a has all the little secrets, maybe we should make it a habit.
There's great resources out there. You know, there's great resources on the internet, but it's kind of unreliable. And so it's really good to have good, reliable sources. And, you know, and I wish I had said it before he called in, but usually I say, we call ourselves the in-person What to Expect before
what to expect while you're expecting.
You're the what to expect incarnate.
Yes, we are.
Okay. All right. Another caller, Nancy, is on the line. And 210-614-8980 if you want to join our conversation as we talk about infant mortality in San Antonio. Nancy, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am a newborn photographer here in the San Antonio area, so I talk to new moms all the time. And I'd like to make two points. One, and it was also my experience when I had my children, when you are in labor and delivery, they treat you at the hospitals like a queen. And once you have your baby, they move you to another area, and you can't. It's very hard to get. You can get room service quicker than you can get care inside your room with your child. And I, too, read. I was 32 years old, college educated when I had my first child. I had excellent during my pregnancy care. But until you go through it, you don't know. And unless someone comes in there and helps you, talking about breastfeeding, you're clueless. And especially if you're one that has really sought out knowledge, you're very apprehensive and nervous because you don't know what to expect until you go through it. Nobody really tells you this is going to happen to your body. This is what's going, I heard earlier, I've been listening to the call, to the show about, I freaked out when I took my child home and he had his first bowel movement because it was such a strange color. Nobody told me about that. There's a lot to go on, and the thing is don't drop the ball once you have that child. I had severe bleeding, and I have a lot of mothers that tell me this, and nobody is concerned. I got up and went to the bathroom in the middle of the night, bleeding buckets as I walked. My husband was not able to spend the night with my second child. Mm. I didn't have any towels.
Thank you for the call. We're going to get some other callers in here, but let me address this. So apparently women feel isolated, and they don't have to. There are points of contact. We've got to figure out ways to get out of these.
Right. I think that speaks to, again, those the differences across, communities. We're talking about health literacy here and the ability of women to, stand up for themselves, to when you do that reproductive life planning, have that birth plan, know what to expect, and then also know how to get your needs met. If they're not paying attention to you, how are you going to address that? If you don't think about that ahead of time and have a plan for it, when you're lost in the confusion of postpartum, it's not going to happen.
And so I do want to, San Antonio also has a problem with maternal mortality as well, and mm-hmm. And as Texas. So we need to think about that in the same,
Absolutely. They're so connected.
All right. Another caller. This is Eric. Eric, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. My wife and I, we had a lot of tragedy when we were trying to get pregnant. We lost two babies. And now we have our third baby, and she's healthy and doing great. And my wife's maternity leave is about to be over, so we're kind of freaking out, and we're worried about the bond that the mom and my wife and our little baby have. Just need some advice or some reconciliation. I know every woman does it. It's just really hard to think about my wife having to go back to work. So,
Eric, thank you for the call. When moms go back to work, is that something that leads to the infant mortality rate that we have here in San Antonio? Any thoughts? Are we able to identify when's the most likely time when these things happen? And maybe there's a trigger there. So back to Dr. Eileen, you help with this study. What are y'all seeing?
Well, I think this question of bonding is probably a separate question that some of your other guests can answer, that transition back. I can talk about my own personal experiences. But as far as infant mortality rates, really the primary drivers are things that we're seeing occurring, before or during pregnancy and in those first few weeks after. That's where most of the effects and the outcomes occur. So I think as far as, that transition to back to work or that's not probably a primary driver, but it certainly raises a lot of concerns for parents, and helping the strategies to help relieve that are probably important. So but I think the breastfeeding is one of those things that, you know, being able to continue that is certainly something I know a lot of moms value in continuing that bond when they come home if they're able to pump during work. And there are a lot of programs, you know, efforts. Some workplaces are better than others at making that, continuing to make that available, make that an option for moms when they get back to work.
I know it doesn't help Eric with his situation. He was really asking for some real, you know, actionable advice. But in the United States, we don't have the maternity leave that we have in other Western developed countries, and they see improved infant mortality rates. And I don't know if there's a correlation between the two, but that does exist. Any advice for the guy at all? Because he really seemed like he needed some help.
For the mother needs to be empowered to demand, not simply ask her employer to give her the time to be able to pump. One of the things that is a higher risk is who's that child going to be staying with, whether it's going to be a home daycare, or is it going to be a real daycare, or is it going to be grandma. So very careful consideration needs to be put to where that baby stays. And when you have limited means, that puts you at higher risk. For this guy who wants to make sure the bonding continues, if the child stays with somebody that can FaceTime the mom and the baby while she's pumping, will help a lot during the day. And then at night, remember, we want the babies to sleep in the same room. And so wake up every 3 hours to breastfeed.
Okay, another caller. This is Sam. And Sam, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, my question has to do with, you know, right around the time my child was born, there was a study that came out saying swaddling after 6 months old might contribute to a higher rate of infant mortality and SIDS. And where I'm going with this is actually that I looked up the study itself, and it was based upon 14 deaths, very small number. It was just a meta-analysis. But there's been other information that's shown that the United States has one of the highest rates of infant mortality out of all developed nations, and yet we also have the highest rate of vaccinations of all developed nations. And the higher the number of vaccinations, the higher number of deaths.
Okay, so I want to challenge you on that. The United States does not have one of the higher rates of vaccinations. You can look at almost all those other developed countries that have improved infant mortality rates, and you're going to see that they have better vaccination rates than we do. Even third world countries have better vaccination rates than the United States has. But to this original point about swaddling the child, that is, you know, wrapping the child, and you know, can you kind of myth bust that? What do we know about that?
Yes, I have read that study extensively, and it's not supported by scientific literature and review. So we do not believe that the child should not be swaddled. Now, by the time the child is 6 months old, the child is actually moving a lot and should be able to push himself, and so there's really no need to swaddle. And we actually, when we swaddle any baby, we ask that the hands are by the face so that they can suit themselves.
So back to real quick, there as our last closing minute here with Dr. Eileen Nemi, with the study that you conducted here, looking at the the infant mortality in communities across Texas. What do you want us to really make the takeaway? What is the big nugget here?
Well, I think one of the big nuggets is that our overall low rates in Texas, or at least comparable to the U.S., and you pointed out that we're not doing as well compared to, you know, nationally, but that we shouldn't be too relaxed and say we're doing fine here in Texas, that we want to continue to improve infant mortality rates. And one way to do that is to look at where the areas are where we're seeing really higher rates. And I think that what the data show is there are pockets within this overall large state where we really are seeing these very
high
rates.
And these are pockets of poverty, and these are places where we should do more work to deliver services to the people who need this help the most. I want to thank all of our guests this afternoon, all of our fantastic callers. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.